to SER Breakfast.
Now, over the weekend, I couldn't believe this story when I first saw it. The Telegraph reported on the trend of pregnant teen girls taking up smoking so their babies would be smaller. What? The graphic messages on plain packaging are not only being misunderstood, but they're actually encouraging some people to smoke in different ways. You know, people getting different packs. You know, that I want the eye, or I want the dead toe, or whatever it is. So what messages are smokers actually getting from these government health warnings? Is the government's kind of heavy-handed treatment of smokers, is it pushing people the other way? Have we become completely desensitised to it? Joining me on the line is Dr. Simone Dennis. She's an anthropologist from ANU whose research uncovered this practice amongst young pregnant women. And she's on the line now to lift the haze on this issue. Good morning, Dr. Dennis.
Good morning.
I'm just flabbergasted by this. How did you find this out?
It is a flabbergasting story, isn't it? I found it out quite close to the beginning of my research, which started a bit over 10 years ago now. The approach I took was to walk up to people who were smoking in public space with my clipboard and ask them some questions about how they were experiencing the rollout of a range of legislation designed to curtail smoking. And, of course, when I saw young women who were obviously pregnant having a cigarette, I made a beeline for them because they stand out, you know, see someone doing that. And I sat them down for an interview. I initially made contact with about five of them who were in a group, and they explained to me that they had learned from the packaging messaging that you could reduce the birth weight of your baby by smoking, and they had all done that. Now, some of them had started smoking for the first time, and others were smoking harder in order to sort of make that public health promise come true. So it was a really interesting story right at the start of my research.
So you found these women, and they straight up just said, "Oh, well, the reason I'm smoking is because my baby will weigh less when it's born."
Well, yeah, I found it a little bit difficult to sort of keep judgment out of my hearing.
Oh, goodness, yes. You know, have you got rocks in your head?
Everybody else is when I first came across it, and I thought, oh, my goodness. But this turned out to be a really overriding fear that these women had. They were very young, so they were quite small people.
So presumably the lesser the weight of the child coming out, the easier the pregnancy?
Yeah, that's what they thought. Now, we know this is not always the case, but some of them had horror stories about people that they knew, sisters, for example, and other friends who had terrible labours because their baby had been big, and they thought, okay, I'm going to do whatever I can to reduce the birth weight of this baby. So smoking was a key strategy that they had been using. Now, obviously, that is not the way that the health messaging is intended to be understood, but it did show that people were quite creative in the way that they sort of marketed to themselves what the messages could mean. So the other interesting thing about that story that sort of I found quite a lot across my fieldwork and that other researchers have also found, you know, people using this strategy, was that it really brought home to me that people do know that smoking is bad for them and that there are damaging effects from it, but they can still tailor those messages in a way that makes it fairly precise and tailored to their own life. Mm. But this group of young women, like many of the people in my study, belong to a class of smokers that we might call resilient smokers, who haven't been particularly impacted by the messaging that really in Australia the middle classes have. So we've seen great effects in the middle classes. We've got one of the lowest smoking rates in the world. We don't see very many young people picking up this habit anymore. But outside that area, we've got groups of resilient smokers, low socioeconomic kind of groupings, and migrants and Aboriginal people who have remained fairly resilient to this messaging. And when that happens, we tend to get those groups bearing the burden of that messaging. The harder it gets, the more kind of, you know, graphic it becomes. And all of that sort of stuff is an unevenly borne burden now.
Mm. If you just joined us, I'm here with Dr. Simone Dennis from ANU. She's an anthropologist who's been doing this research into basically Australia's smoking patterns, I suppose. Why do you think it is that you're talking about these resilient smokers? Why is it that they have been so resilient?
Well, a lot of the time, you know, that group picks up smoking more strongly and remains with it more sort of hard, I suppose, because you've got a number of conditions that already sort of speak to smoking. So there are a lot of pleasures, I suppose, in smoking, a lot of social entailments in smoking. We tend to see it picked up in these groups and remain there much more sturdily than in the middle classes. So if you've got some pretty heavy burdens to bear already, you know, financially, socioeconomically, in marginalisation terms, we tend to see smoking concentrated in that group. And that's certainly the pattern in Australia and across the Western world. This is now a habit or a practice of those people who are marginalised. We find it there more than anywhere else, and it seems to be very tricky to shift.
Mm. Well, those warning messages on the plain packets that we have now, I mean, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. You've got, you know, that small baby, or there's like a dead foot.
We've got the horrible foot, we've got the tongue.
The tongue, the eyes.
The great big cancer on it. We've got the eye, and the eye one was fascinating to me because I had quite a lot of blue-eyed people in my study, which contained hundreds of people.
Mm.
And often people who got that blue eye, who had blue eyes themselves, would return that pack and say, oh, God, that looks way too much like my eye.
Really?
I don't want that one. I'll take anything. I'll take heart disease. I'll take lung disease, but I don't want that. So we saw a lot of people returning packets and asking for different ones.
Mm.
And if they couldn't do that, they would often take their cigarettes out of that packet that they found really offensive and put them into something prettier, like a tin that they'd kept or something like that.
And I suppose I know smokers who they're quite sceptical of those warnings, those hazards on the packets. There's one, for example, which is a gentleman, Brian.
Yeah, Brian. Is this story Brian came up a lot.
Yes, every smoker I've ever spoken to seems to know about Brian. It's this picture of this kind of emaciated man. And then there's a picture of him, I think it's 10 days before, 10 weeks before, looking very healthy and hale. And the story is that Brian, you know, lung cancer, you know, basically turned Brian into this living skeleton and then he died. However, a lot of smokers, they always tell me, oh, well, the thing with Brian is he actually had AIDS and the government's just using that as an example and it's not true, so that doesn't actually happen. Like, there's all these justifications.
Yeah, heaps of those. And Brian, it came up quite a lot. People did not believe that Brian was actually died with that rapidity and died of a smoking-related illness. Brian is a kind of compilation story drawn from other sorts of experiences of smoking that did result in rapid death. So there's sort of a bit of a compilation around the graphics and the story, but it's a bit of an urban myth that Brian died of AIDS.
Yes.
But you can see why this is such a kind of compelling story, because he looks okay and then he looks dreadful and then he's dead.
Yes.
But people found ways of accepting themselves from that story, and one common way was saying, well, look, I've got grandparents who died when they were in their 90s and they were both heavy smokers and, you know, I've inherited iron lungs and I don't need
well
to
done.
Worry about that.
Yeah, well so, done. Yeah.
But it's not really a strange story. We all do this in some way when we're confronted by something that's frightening. We can often sort of find ways that make that thing not apply to us particularly.
Mm. Plus that kind of invincibility gene that we humans generally have.
But what I found is that the harder that the government goes on it, the more these smokers were being sort of pushed in the other direction, that there was a resilience about what they were doing, and they were not being reached anymore by this kind of mother of all health warnings, I guess.
Dr. Simone Dennis is here with me from ANU. She's an anthropologist who's been looking at Australia's smoking culture for the last decade or so. So do you think we're becoming desensitized? You know, do you think smokers are becoming desensitized to these shocking images?
Yeah, I think that's the case. A lot of people said that, you know, they don't need to worry about them anymore. They've kind of dealt with them. They're over that. They've seen them all before, which does beg the question of what will the government make that will be the mother of all health warnings. But even if they do that, you know, I would expect to see the same kind of strategies around avoiding or telling yourself about them in particular ways. But on the other side of it, the denormalisation campaign around smoking, where non-smokers are encouraged to tell smokers how they feel about smoking, has been very successful. So the other thing I found in my research is smokers being abused in the street when they were smoking.
Right.
So it was not uncommon for me to have non-smokers pass by and pull their T-shirts up over their nose or start to cough and splutter and then you know, fire a lot of abuse off at smokers for giving them cancer or for being contagious in public and spreading disease. Now, that was a really interesting kind of finding, because smoking in the outdoors, secondhand smoke in the outdoors, is nowhere near as dangerous as secondhand smoke in the indoors, and the science is very equivocal about it. You need some really specific conditions to be met. You've got to stay there for a long time. You've got to have the right density of smoke in the air, and you've got to have it downwind. So not many people who I saw were experienced smoke like
those
that,
exact
but they
situation,
still thought it was going to give them cancer. So we're seeing if you're already socially, economically marginalised and you're bearing a burden already like that, that kind of abuse is pretty hard to take.
So the rise of, I guess, smoke shaming.
Yes, smoke shaming is very, very common, and there's a big difference between the kind of stinky smell that's sort of polluting and makes you feel a bit yucky to actually being harmed by that. And so people had conflated that and have thoroughly bought into this idea that these smokers are dangerous, and this is only going to get more pointed, I think, with the rise of third-hand smoke, which is that smell that lingers on a smoker after they've had a cigarette. This is also now starting to be regarded as something that is very dangerous. And in the US already, we've seen people lose their jobs over this, or be denied access to public transport or access to public spaces. And so once we start seeing that, and it isn't actually a pressing danger, we're starting to exclude people from public participation.
Oh, goodness, what are they meant to do? Go to Coles and buy themselves a can of Lynx and then get on the bus? I mean, really?
Well, you know, as you might know, smoking is a really difficult smell to budge. And so, you know, if you're a teenager and had a fag and you sprayed yourself with a bit of Brew 33 after, your dad's still going to know. So this is a lingering smell, but people have started to connect it up with, this is a dangerous smell and this person could hurt me. Of course, that isn't true, but it is starting to have a grip on people's lives in a way that's really consequential.
Thank you so much for your time, Simone. I could talk to you all day, but the news is bearing it down on me. But we'll have to catch up soon, because we could talk about this all day, I think.
We could. Let's do that.
All right. No worries. Thanks so much. That's Dr. Simone Dennis there. She is an anthropologist from ANU. She's been studying smoking habits over the last 10 years in Australia. And I can't believe that. Pregnant teen girls smoking so their babies would be smaller, so that the pregnancy wasn't quite so difficult. Holy Nelly, as they say in the classics.